To order, we have seven bills on the agenda. Senator Seaman, we're going to let her go first. I believe her committee is meeting at 12:30, so. Senate File 1704, gasoline sales near terminals, pricing regulations. Welcome to the committee, Senator Seaman.
Thank you, Chair Metzen and members of the committee. Members, Senate File 1704 is really somewhat unusual bill, I think, in that we, Representative Dan Schoen, who represents St. Paul Park, and I introduced this after being frustrated about not being able to explain to our constituents a problem. And the problem that we found is that although there is a refinery located within the city limits of St. Paul Park, and there are big petroleum storage tanks in the city of Newport. So we're talking about a large refinery that's very closely located to neighborhoods, to homes. Gas prices in this area have consistently been higher than surrounding communities. And so the bill that's before you, I think, takes a rather creative way of trying to address this concern. What it says is that, as you'll see, is that gas prices can't be higher within the 7-mile radius of the refinery than they are at retail locations under the same ownership within 35 miles of the terminal. Members, you know that when you go door knocking, you often hear unusual things that come up at the doors. One thing over the time I've been in the legislature that I'll consistently hear is, why are gas prices in Newport or Cottage Grove, why are they higher than they are in Hastings, or why are they higher than they are in Woodbury? So we're talking, those of you who aren't as familiar with the East Metro, or Mr. Chair, why are they higher in Newport when the refinery is right there than they are in South St. Paul?
Better representation, probably.
I shouldn't have said that.
No, that was a good lead. No, it was.
She's working on it.
You have a strong co-author out here too, so it's.
I do. Okay. I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Seaman, I'm sorry. I just was.
So the South Washington County Bulletin did a investigative journalism piece on this very subject that I'm not sure if members have in their packet or not. But as you'll notice, they did a 10-week review of fuel prices and found that the average cost of gas in Cottage Grove was at most 8 cents more than it is in Woodbury. But even with having the oil refinery in St. Paul Park, during a 7-day period, there were 50 days when the gas was lower in Woodbury than it was in St. Paul Park. I should also mention that we, Representative Schoen and I, have requested explanations to this of Northern Tier, which owns the refinery in St. Paul Park, and have never really gotten an answer or an explanation. And so, sort of out of frustration of not being able to explain this or understand it, when again there's a refinery. The refinery owns the gas station, which is located in Newport, less than a mile from the refinery, and gas prices are always consistently higher. Okay. That's why we brought this legislation forward. After it was announced that this legislation was moving, the local city councils and mayors were very enthusiastic about it. And so with me to testify today are three members of the Newport City Council. I should also mention that there are numerous, I can think of at least three members of the Cottage Grove City Council who wanted to be here today to testify in support, but were unable to make it. But with that, I'll turn it over to the mayor of Newport, Tim Garrity, who I should add, in case he doesn't, lives really close to this refinery,
yes,
too.
Mayor, welcome to the Commerce Committee and the Minnesota Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. And first of all, I do want to support some form of legislation that will help our communities out. Newport's a small community of about 3,700 people, and we have the Mississippi River on one side of us and Woodbury and St. Paul and South St. Paul and Cottage Grove surrounding us. And there was a time, maybe 5-10 years ago, I would not have supported this legislation. But as you know, Mr. Chair, we went through major construction with the Wakota Bridge and Highway 61. And prior to that construction, we were supporting 3 gas stations. So since that changed and we're down to 1 station, the pricing seems to have gone up and some gouging going on. The city of Newport has petroleum tanks on the north side of town, primarily for Holiday gas stations, and at the southern part of town, it's the Northern Tier Energy petroleum tanks, and they primarily support the SA stations. And currently, we have an SA station in Newport. And I just find it mind-boggling that we could almost put a garden hose and connect and get gas directly because the transport facilities are right there, and how why it costs more to transport gas a mile away than it does to Blaine, Fridley, or St. Paul. I like to support our businesses in town, and I do go to the SA, but not all the time. I find going driving to work up on Snelling, it's a lot cheaper. But being a good mayor, I do give some business to our local gas station.
And, you could cross the river and go over to South St. Paul. You know.
Well, I've done that on occasion. My son lives there, Mr. Chair, so he contributes. But anyway, whether it's this form or some other form, maybe the refinery should be required to put a wholesale gas pump for the public to use on their premises. I know a lot of times they give employees wholesale prices. Maybe that's a solution. I don't know, but we've Councilman Tom Ingeman has raised this over the years publicly at our meetings, and we don't get any answers to it. And I just don't understand why we should pay more when we, I mean, for the most part, they are a good business, a good partner, but why they would do this and take advantage of a small community and price it higher, I don't know. But actually, I went onto their website this morning and looked at their commitment to their customers, and it says, we pledge to provide our customers with outstanding service and will strive to have delighted customers, not just satisfied customers. Well, there's a few of us that aren't satisfied, let alone delighted. Also, a commitment to their suppliers and vendors. We commit to be a valued partner and to conduct ourselves with the utmost integrity, to live up to the obligations, and to adhere to the highest ethical standards. Well, I would invite them to do that and step forward and do the right thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Senator Kozoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, just a few questions. First of all, are you saying they're unethical? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think I just logically can't figure out why it costs more to get gas leads to St. Paul Park and the city of Newport when they transfer it hundreds of miles away and probably are getting less, you know, charging less at those retail stores. I'm not saying they're unethical, but I guess to the highest ethical standard, they're not there.
There it is. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, to the testifier, you talked about there was 3 gas stations there and now there's 1. Do you know why the other 2 went out of business? What was the...
Well, the highway basically divided. We had 3 stop-and-go lights in the city of Newport at the time at grade crossings, and we put the new Wakota Bridge in, and now we're down to 1 overpass, 1 exit in town.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask some questions later. I just want to hear the whole testimony.
Okay. Do you have, Senator Seaman, do you have another witness, sir?
Yes, Mr. Ingeman, who's also on the city, also on the Newport City Council, please.
Well, welcome to the committees.
Well, thank you, sir. I do buy my gas... my name is Thomas Ingeman, and I do buy my gas in South St. Paul because it is cheaper. I've been complaining to the city council for quite a while. It just strikes me as rather peculiar that a company that has to transport gasoline many miles away can provide the gasoline cheaper than it can when it's right next door to its own home base. Now, I understand marketing, and I understand corporate greed, and to me, this doesn't smell right. I don't know what you want to call it, but, you know, we put up with their refinery odors. If they have a problem, our fire departments respond to their problem. but however, they charge us the highest. Now, is that a reward for being a neighbor? I don't think so. To be honest with you, I think we're getting screwed. I'll let it go with that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Councilman. You have another witness?
Mr. Gallagher, who's also on the Newport City Council, Mr. Chair.
Gallagher, welcome, Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for having us speak today. In a different note, I'm sorry, my name is Stephen Gallagher. On a different note, I'd like to talk about the economic impact of having higher gas prices in our area, St. Paul Park, Cottage Grove, Newport. People that come home from work generally stop to get their gas somewhere else, maybe Woodbury, St. Paul. That money is not coming into our community. People will stop, get groceries, other shopping, other errands. Well, that could be done in our local area, but now it's being switched out directly because of gas prices at this point. As Senator Stevens said, when we door knock, that's the one thing we consistently hear is that gas prices in our city are extremely high. Taking that, people shop other places. They don't come to our area. They don't stop in our area when they see how much gas prices are, and it's really hurting our economy. As the mayor spoke about, once the Okuda Bridge came through, that hurt our community and our economic stability. Now we're trying to build it back up. This is one piece that's kind of hurting us or bringing us back. So the entire city council, this was voted five to nothing for unanimous support. I've talked to other city council members and mayors around the surrounding communities. Every one of them said they support this. Thank you.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the refinery ever tried to explain to you why the prices are higher there?
We've asked and got no explanations whatsoever.
Interesting. Thank you.
I'm a little little surprised at that. Usually a senator from the district, they should call you back, but apparently not. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Senator Goodwin asked.
Okay, what are we going to do with this?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ahern, did you wish to testify? Yes, we got it.
Mr. Chair, I think this is the testimony we've been waiting for. The communities have been waiting for the explanation of why the gas prices are higher.
Mr. Ahern.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Ahern, and I'm appearing here on behalf of the very newly minted a lobbyist on behalf of Northern Tier Energy. In fact, Northern Tier, I shouldn't mention, owns the and operates the refinery in St. Paul Park, and also owns and operates the Super America stores. A majority controlling interest in Northern Tier Energy very recently just changed hands. And quite literally, a new management team is being put into place for Northern Tier. And in fact, I registered for lobbying on Friday of last week, and I had to hold up waiting for a new slate of officers and directors of the company. I visited with Senator Sieben and Representative Schoen just to let them know that there is some new management here, and I understand there's been some considerable frustration with the lack of engagement from the previous management. And what I would request is some time to get the new team in place and one that will answer some questions. What I can tell you is that the folks that are part of the new management team already run a couple of different refineries, one in El Paso, Texas, and one in Gallup, New Mexico, and they have a good number of convenience stores in conjunction with them. So very similar operations. And I do think that they pride themselves on being good neighbors and responsive. And so I would request the committee kind of provide us at least an opportunity to become better neighbors than I think perhaps has been the case in the past.
Senator Kosoko.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, so I hear you saying that you are willing to work with the interested parties on the other side and that you're new and that you're looking for that opportunity. And if that's what I hear you saying, Mr. Chair, I think maybe we should consider laying it over and letting them work at it. You know, my concern overall is, you know, if we start mandating what a business can and cannot do, I'm concerned. For example, 3M, you know, they do Post-it and among other things, and well, it should be cheaper here because they're right next door. And you know, I think as we look through how we do it, if we can find the two sides to figure it out, Senator Stephen, you're saying that hasn't happened in the past. The testifier is saying he's new and wants to do it. I would hope we would try to get that as a win-win rather than us forcing somebody to do something.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stephen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, thank you for those comments. I was thinking along the same lines. I obviously know Mr. Ahern from being around the Capitol and want to publicly apologize for putting him in the tight time frame that we did, being that he registered on Friday and today is Monday. But with that being said, this is a very serious matter for our district, and we want an explanation at the very least of what is driving this. And I understand that he's not able to give us that explanation today, but if perhaps the committee would be willing to lay the bill on the table and we could talk about it, and you to talk about it, to express that we are serious in pursuing this, but we're not quite ready to move there today. We'd appreciate it. I would appreciate it.
The mayor and the council members, I think this is we're going in the right direction here, and I think you have their attention. I'll tell you that when they come before the Minnesota Senate like this, I think we'll get their attention now. Senator Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I'm a little more comfortable with our rules on the floor where we don't lay things over versus laying on the table. And I just want to – I know a lot of times people sit in here and they hear lay on the table and they think that that's killing something. So I don't know if the more correct motion is to lay it on the table so that it's clear we want to have more conversation about this and we can pick it up and bring it back.
Counselor, did you
Mr. Chair, Senator Reinhart, generally the Commerce Committee, the chair is just able to lay over a bill on his own initiative, and the committee, I think, has never really had a problem with that.
And Mr. Chair, counsel, does that then still allow committee member the ability to bring it back?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Reinhart, usually the bill would have to be scheduled and noticed for that. I have not recalled that being a problem in Commerce before.
With this chair? No, I'm...
It's enough out of you. Senator Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there's a couple things. I wonder if there's any timeline for when this decision is going to be made, because it seems to me like it's been going on for quite a while. And, you know, I'd like to see a real good faith effort on behalf of the company or the new board or whatever it is to really do this. I can't see, maybe I just don't know, but I can't see any kind of an explanation for that. For the gas being higher and that close to the refinery. And I think the arguments made here by the council were excellent. You know, they have to put up with the smell. They have to put up with a lot of stuff from the refinery. And if anything, the gas prices seem to me like they should be lower. But whatever it is, can we get some kind of a timeline so we know that before the end of this session, we have to bring this bill back up again? We will.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Goodwin. I will be getting the new team up here as soon as I can, and I'm committed to sit down with the Senator and Representative Schoen and other members of the community that are concerned with this, and we will engage.
Thank you. And one more comment, Mr. Chair. To the Mayor, I represent Fridley, so I don't want those prices to go up. You mentioned Fridley.
And you have my promise, too, that we'll be following this as we go. But Senator Reinhart's motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Sieben. Senator Latz, two bills on the agenda, Senate File 2445 and Senate File 2108. I welcome Senator Latz, and you may proceed. I see you have a couple of witnesses here with you today also. So, Senator Latz.
Mr. Donlevy?
No, I'm here on behalf of the Missouri Land Association.
Yeah, I thought he was going to be here too, but okay. He didn't show up.
I can speak on his behalf in all likelihood.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 2445 addresses a concern about an existing statute that we want to make sure continues in force in the same way that it has been utilized and interpreted over the years. There was a recent court decision in the Court of Appeals regarding the interpretation of certain foreclosure statutes. And the court decision itself doesn't have any direct impact on the statute of limitations for bringing actions relating to mortgage foreclosure and titles. But if you were to draw the line through a couple of dots from that court decision, it's possible someone could make such a claim. And so this is a preventive bill in order to allow to make clear that the statute of limitations will remain the same and the title companies will be able to issue clear title to allow the sale of property. I have with me Ron Elwood from Legal Aid, who's going to take a few moments to describe the bill in a little more detail. And I'll tell you, as far as I know, there's no opposition to this bill.
I'm going to, Senator Latz, I, for one, would like to hear that this is kind of a standalone bill, and it's worked out with the, I see your co-author, Senator Kosalka, but there are a few, I'll be honest with you, a few foreclosure bills around the building, and I would like to be, at least as a chair, if I could ask this question, assured that this has worked out and this bill will be going on its own.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't intend to merge it with any other foreclosure bills, and I'm informed that Legal Aid, the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association, the Bankers Association, the Association of Realtors, the Title Association, the Credit Union Network, and the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota all support the bill.
I'm sure of that, but I felt like I had to ask that question. Senator Kosalka.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And even Senator Latz and Senator Kosalka agree.
Yeah, strange bedfellows.
They're gonna call into question the judgments of both of us, I think.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Okay, Mr. Elwood, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Given the conversation just took place, I'm not sure I really want to say too much. But I will say that this is kind of a small technical bill, but it does have very large implications on assuring marketability of title and the buying and selling of homes in Minnesota. Essentially, the bill is here before you to ensure that title companies can continue to issue title insurance, lenders can continue to lend, realtors can continue to broker deals, and most importantly, people can continue to buy and sell homes with confidence. I'm happy to answer any questions. I think the rest of it's been talked about, and I know we have somebody else from the Title Association
any
that
questions
would support the bill.
Elwood? Okay, your next witness, Senator.
Thank you very much, Senator Metzen. I'm Nancy Landmark. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Land Title Association. We concur with the comments that Mr. Elwood has made and believe that this bill confirms the ability to continue to encourage the transactions of real estate, especially post-foreclosure, and allows us a point of certainty, which is critical in our business. Thank you, sir.
Any further questions of Senator Latz or the witnesses?
Small committee
banks. Just have to go anywhere else. Or judiciary. So, Mr. Elwood, did you?
Mr. Chair and members, also there actually are two sections to the bill, and the other section, just for your edification, last year we, with your help, Mr. Chair, and the members of this committee, we passed a bipartisan unanimous foreclosure bill, and in that we made a temporary exception for some of the small banks and small credit unions and some of the small community banks, and the other section of this bill simply makes that exemption permanent.
Okay. Does this have to go to your committee, Senator Letts, or the committee you chair?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that'll be the motion. Any further discussion? Anybody? Senator Letts, we're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2445 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
On the Letts motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much. We have another... That's Bill. 2108, Sales Representative Agreement, Certain Practices Prohibition. What number is that one? 2108.
Which one are we doing next? Sales. Yeah, I don't see that one.
Oh, okay. Senator Letts, we're dealing with Senate File 2108. Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2108 is a provision that would protect Minnesota residents who are sales representatives, who represent out-of-state companies, in the sense that if they ever had a dispute relating to their contract with the manufacturer, with the company for which they are the sales representative, to ensure that that dispute gets resolved under Minnesota law and in Minnesota courts. Directly, it prohibits provisions in those sales representative contracts that require that disputes be resolved under laws in, say, California or Oklahoma or New York or wherever the manufacturer, for example, is based, which, as a practical matter, are near impossible for a Minnesota sales representative, either a company or an individual, to be able to enforce. It certainly increases the expenses, and it puts them in a great disadvantage for those provisions. This bill simply says that a manufacturer, wholesaler, assembler, or importer cannot circumvent compliance with Minnesota's consumer protection laws, or 325E in particular, by including any provision in their sales representative agreement that purports to require them to resolve their issues under the law in another state. And it also separately provides that any such provision, if it were in a contract, would be void and unenforceable. And so it obviously cannot apply to contracts that are currently in force. That would be an unconstitutional impairment of contracts. But it would apply to any new sales representative contracts that are entered into, and also to renewals of existing contracts, because a renewal is, in fact, a new contract. As far as I'm aware, there is no opposition to this bill.
Senator Pratt, did you have a bill similar to this last year, my recollection, or no?
I did, Mr. Chairman, and this one appears to be a bit more comprehensive than the one I had submitted last year, so I'm going to... I signed on to this one, and we'll support this one over.
Okay, I recollect that you did. You want a couple of witnesses? Want to say a few words?
Mr. Chairman, they're only available to answer questions if there are any. I will note and appreciate the bipartisan support on this bill, Senator Pratt included.
Thank you.
Senator Pratt, this might be a good time for you to make a motion, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 2108 pass the committee and be referred to Judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, I understand it can go straight to the floor.
Then to the floor.
Any discussion on that? Hearing not all those in favor, so you might be saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Letts.
Thank you.
Okay. Remaining bills are members of the committee. Senator Carlson, are you ready for a couple of your bills? You going to take 2446 first, Senator Carlson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that's the Commerce Department.
No.
You're a different title, though.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I'll let you go. You welcome, Senator, and you may proceed.
And Mr. Chair, we actually have 2446 is labeled 2081, and 2081 is a title that doesn't show up there because there was just a slight mistype there of having 2446 and 2178 read the same title. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2446 is the Department of Commerce unsession bill, making a lot of minor changes, a few changes that were a bit larger, but I do have an author's amendment that I would like to move prior to going any further. The author's amendment. The author's amendment is a change that makes modifications to the bill language and does not change some parts of the statute, and keeps parts of it that have been in place for 50 years where there isn't a substantial change. We're going to leave it alone. And this was requested by the insurance industry. Okay, I'd like to move that, the A3 amendment.
Like we'll let the I think this is a trust me amendment. You've got delete 5307, delete. Were you taking out repealers?
No, I don't think so. We're getting it.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rothman, have you sure you're working hand in hand with Senator Carlson, and these are changes that we should do. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The department originally wanted to do these things. We've felt that if it led to significant controversy, that's not what we wanted to do. So to keep this in a non-controversial bill, these are relatively fine changes, so the department doesn't have any issue with these changes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to accept that A3 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. You have another amendment, Senator Carlson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have the A1 amendment, which is a technical change amendment. It makes just some language changes, corrections in the original bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, there's no issue with these either. We're okay.
Senator Carlson moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape he'd like it in. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, most of the changes are small in their effect or no effect. As the commissioner has said, we've tried to make sure that there are no controversial items in here. The technical amendment makes a change that that would have otherwise made this a candidate for going to judiciary, and this change makes that enough of a change so that it doesn't need to go to the judiciary. And there are, as far as I know, there are. I believe I have that, Senator Latz. That I have a.
You don't want to come before my committee?
No.
Not necessarily.
That's the vice chair.
That's heard so often around.
Yeah.
Avoid Latz if you can. Okay.
Yes. And Mr. Chair and members, this is this bill enumerates many different and smaller changes. And, of course, the one that you've heard the most about is it actually removes that language that causes the illegally sized fruit containers to not be sold. For the most part, there is nothing that is controversial in it, and it is almost 100% cleanup language.
Senator Kosoka, what do you think?
Mr. Chair, it's a massive bill, and there's a bunch of trusts going on here. We did have a conference call with Commissioner Rothman, but I do have one question. Section 40,
I've been told that that deals with grants for low-income weatherization services. Can I just understand what we're doing in that section?
Which, what page?
Section 40.
There's several Section 40s.
They're peeling a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, there's a Section 40 on page 32.
Oh, page 32.
Page 55.
Oh. Article 1, Section 40.
55. Section 40.
Oh. Section 40.
It's a repealer.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Senator Gazelka, that's a good catch, actually. That was not supposed to be in the final version presented to the committee. So we should, whatever we need to do to clean that up.
Page 32 40. On the bottom.
Article 1, Section 40.
Yeah,
and the repealers, Mr. Chair, on page 55, are they? That's another Section 40. Is that a different, entirely, or is that part of this Section 40?
Different.
Which, yeah, somebody can.
There's two Section 40. Oh, that's Article 2. Is that correct? Oh.
Okay, let's.
Wait, Article 1, Section 40 is on page 32, though.
Yes.
Is that what you wanted to do?
Yes.
About petroleum's not
so we're talking only
low-income weatherization.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Mr. Stang tell us what we should do.
Mr. Chairman, members, if I understand Commissioner Rothman properly, a motion to delete Section 40 of Article 1 would be in order.
Article 1.
Okay, yeah, we want it to be.
Is that right? Yeah, I'll make that motion.
Did you want to respond, Commissioner, or anything?
Yeah. Mr. Right. Chair, it should be deleted. It's, I can explain why, but it.
That's all right. I think you probably get the
We don't want it in, Mr. Chair.
That's that.
On the Kasalka motion. Yeah. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those motion prevails. That's deleted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else to say, Carlson?
Well,
Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair.
Department's good with it, and
Commissioner would like to.
Okay, sure, fine.
Yeah, just Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka and members. You know, obviously, this is the governor's initiative to do the unsession. Let me point out some major highlights so that that there is some uncomfortableness to it, or that there is some comfort. The this bill contains all of the department's unsession proposals except for two areas, telecommunications and energy, just to make sure. Those two bills have been separated out, and those unsession items are in there. The department reviewed 112 chapters and 54 of law and 54 chapters of rules. The department, and I don't know if you know this, has the largest number of pages of any other agency in the state of Minnesota. We followed a very rigorous process, one where we had our staff go through it during the summertime, and then a second time with me, we went through page by page by page and discussed either condensing, consolidating, repealing, or keeping a section as is. If they were controversial items, we wanted to have everybody look at them, and our goal is to not have any whatsoever. I wanted to thank you, Senator Metzen, and Senator Gazelka, for meeting with us and talking about these provisions. The ones that have some significance in terms of what we're doing that may at one day had some concern or with us doing anything are no longer needed. They're just basically obsolete. So, for example, in the banking area, we eliminate the branch banks prohibition. Mr. Chair, you may remember the history of that.
Yeah.
But today, in our world of banking, it's just not. There's no reason to prohibit the branch banking. That fight has been long gone. Federally chartered entities already can do it, as well as state credit unions. So this is, in essence, to bring us up into the modern day of banking. In 60A, we have an old provision. Senator Gazelka and I talked about this one: the insurance sale by vending machines. You just don't do it anymore, and it used to be that you'd go into the airport and you could buy an insurance policy right before you jumped on an airplane. So it's not used, and so we've decided to it's not necessary, and therefore you can delete that, remove it from the statutes. In another area, in the insurance agents area, what we're doing is Really no change whatsoever, except there's a lot of pages devoted to the curriculum for continuing education requirements. We're going to keep all the same requirements, but we're just eliminating them in statutes. It's very prescriptive, and it's not necessary, and we'll do it in sort of an administrative fashion. Another minor area is med sub policies. We don't have to report those. The burglary alarm franchises are unnecessary. They have to register with us in any event. And then, as Senator Carlson referred to, you know, the Department of Commerce has some pretty amazing powers. One of which we caught would allow our weights and measures folks to arrest without even a formal warrant any violation of our weights and measures statutes. It's a vestige of an old provision, and in modern Minnesota and modern America, we would have to comply with the warrant requirements under constitutional law anyway. And then finally, it's just one of those fun facts is that, you know, they used to regulate the size of the containers of your fruit and a flower, and if you violated those container requirements, it was a misdemeanor, and you could be arrested by the Commissioner of Commerce. Well, I'm not going to go out there to Costco and arrest people for not having the right size containers for their fruit. And this eliminates that provision. The rest of the provisions are miscellaneous provisions. They're following the categories I mentioned, and of course, and we've worked on the issues with any stakeholders that come to us that we really want to keep it in a non-controversial position, and we will continue to work with anybody if they do have those. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and if there's any questions, we're happy to answer those.
Senator Jensen, did you have
Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner. And the one section you were talking about regards to broker, and I think it's for real estate and insurance education, where you're removing all the prescripted courses, but you add language that says a curriculum as prescribed and published by the commissioner from time to time. What does that look like for the people that have to develop the curriculum that they then have to try to give to the people that have to meet this requirement?
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, it'll be the same provisions. It's just taking that. Right now, the way it works is that all the course curriculum is passed as a statute, and instead of putting it in the statutes, it'll be the same requirements, but it'll be worked on with the department to, you know, develop it. So all we're doing is we'll be doing is copying that, saying here's what it is, and we're not making any changes substantively whatsoever to those course curriculum requirements.
Senator Jensen.
But the courses are already, that does happen. You say it happens statutorily now. But if we go to what you're talking about, there would have to be some changes that would have to be made. And what would that process look like? I can understand if we just take this, put it in a book, and you publish it. But what would the ongoing ability of the people that have to develop this curriculum and provide it to the people that have to meet the requirement, how are they going to know when time to time is and how it's going to be published? I'm concerned we're going from very prescriptive to basically whatever. And I don't know. I'm not comfortable with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, it's in essence, what I would do is take all of the requirements of this that are in the statute right now, put them in a document, and say these are the requirements. There's not going to be any substantive changes whatsoever, and we're just going to put it out that way. If in fact, you know, there are some. For example, in the future, if there are changes to that, we wouldn't be changing them ourselves. We would be working, of course, with the industry and the folks on what those would be without putting them out without those consultations.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
My concern is that we did this prescriptive because we felt as a legislature that these were the topics that were important for agents and real brokers to have and to do. If we're now replacing it with no process really to make sure that the educational requirements are necessary, I'm concerned what the process is going to be to do that. So by changing the process without laying out what the process is, I'm concerned that we're not going to know how it's supposed to work.
It sounds to me like you don't have a process. You're just going to take this, put it in a publication, and we're done.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, the goal was to take a look. It was just simply this, that there's a lot of pages dedicated to, you know, exactly what, and I think they're set forth in the language of the bill. And it says, you can see, if you start at 6R, it says education and course curriculum, and then it lays it all out, what everything has to be taught, which courses, and all that. It's not our intent. It was just simply to cut the number of pages and words in the statute, because we're not changing anything substantively. And so the process would be to, under the commissioner's authority, to just take those requirements and issue them as the requirements for the department.
To do that.
Take it out if you
don't want. Well, Mr. Chair, I can...
A couple of things we could do here. We could take it out now and or move it along with the promise of further conversation with the senator. And if there's some changes could be made on the floor. We usually like to do it that way, but... because of the time constraints is what I'm thinking of really today.
And I'm comfortable with removing it. I just want to make sure there's something in place to make sure the intent of why it was put in the first place is still maintained, because you are changing the process to make sure that the right curriculum is being presented to the people. And if we just remove this without replacing it with some kind of procedure that's more than just time to time or in a book... No. We're going to lose the legislative intent of why it's in there in the first place.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, I'm happy to have any conversations whatsoever. It's either in the statute. We felt rulemaking was way too slow a process, and if we can work on something, I'm happy to do that as well too. So we can. It's totally whatever you.
Or maybe next year I could come up with something that says how we're going to do it going forward, but. Sure.
But again, Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, I'm happy to work out whatever that process might be for in a little bit more detail if you'd like to do that.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
I know the commissioner's been working with a lot of us and to keep this non-controversial, and he's been doing a good job of that, I think. But Senator Kasoka.
Yeah, I'm okay with Mr. Rothman's position on this. I think over the years, when there's been something that we don't agree with, we find a way to get it done, and I feel comfortable with the direction they're going right now.
And we're still in business here for a while.
This curriculum is
different. Senator Pratt, how are you doing today? Good? What's the pleasure of the... I think we're prepared to move this out and... with the understanding that Senator Carlson and the Commissioner and Senator Jensen, if there's further discussion, they can
Chair, one comment on that. I believe what we saw in the background of this particular initiative was that the Commissioner and the Department works on this language and brings it to the legislature, which puts it into statute. So what we would do is we would just skip that step. The commissioner and the department would work on the language, and it would go directly to the persons that need that curriculum, rather than putting it and detailing it in the statute.
Senator Jensen, did you have
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Carlson, if that's the case, then the answer when I ask the question would be, this is the procedure.
Yes.
And that's not what I got for an answer.
Okay. Senator Carlson, we're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2446 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Carlson. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
You've got the next one up. Senator Carlson, is this 2081? This is an advisory group modifications. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, why don't you proceed, Senator?
Mr. Chair, members, this is Senate File 2081. Is a two changes. One is to modify to to end one of the agencies, or I'm sorry, one of the advisory groups and combine it, and also, let's see, got to make sure that I'm getting, she just pares down three committees. I'm sorry, this is the one that eliminates three committees. The Renewable Hydrogen Initiative Advisory Committee, the Energy Research Education Advisory Committee, and the Energy Advisory Task Force. The original purpose of these groups was to provide guidance to the Commissioner of Commerce and the Legislature on energy-related issues. The Coordinating Commission identified these groups as not having met in any recent memory or as having its expired in statute. So we are just eliminating unused committees. I'll stand for any questions.
Questions from the committee? Senator Carlson, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, unless there is questions. I do have the commissioner here yet.
I believe this has to go to a couple other committees as well. Senator Carlson, what is it?
Environment and State and Local. I don't
have the name of the next committee that goes to.
Environment and
Senator Carlson, if there's no questions from the committee, would you like to make a motion to move it to
Environment and Energy?
Environment and Energy.
Environment and Energy. Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2081 be recommended to pass and referred to the Environment Energy Committee.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up, we have Senate File 2178, Senator Jensen. Welcome, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill has to do with continuing education classes for the insurance and broker, real estate broker, agents and brokers. This legislation was brought to me by the Minnesota Association of Realtors, but it is also supported by the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agent and Broker Association and the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. Senate File 2178 updates licensee education language in Chapter 45 to account for advances in technology and allows licensees to have similar learning experiences, opportunities, and requirements regardless of where they are as long as there is an instructor available. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. I do have an author's amendment.
We have the A1 amendment. Senator Jensen, we want to adopt that as an author's amendment. Include that as an author's amendment.
Yes.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails.
Thank you. I'd like to now introduce Paul Egger with the Minnesota Association of Realtors to provide some additional information about this bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 2178. My name is Paul Egger. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. I just want to thank Senator Jensen and the bipartisan group of co-authors, and also Mr. Spizzetto and his two clients that have worked on this bill. And also the author's amendment that you just adopted was a suggestion from the Department of Commerce. So I want to give them credit for sitting down with us over the interim and giving their feedback recently, which we incorporated into this author's amendment. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. What we really are attempting to do here is to broaden the definition of classroom course to account for other ways that licensees can obtain credit for taking continuing education courses. And in particular, with the with modern technology as such, it's not necessary for a student to be actually in the same classroom as the instructor. Courses can be taught in one location and live simulcast to another. So this bill allows for that. It also allows for students to take courses live on their own time, at their whether at their office or in their home, and just by logging in and verifying that they are who they are, and also from time to time checking in if it's a one-hour course that they're checking in periodically to ensure that they're there for 1 hour. Mr. Chair, one other benefit of this that we saw, and one reason we want to bring it forward, is we think that this will open up some other opportunities for licensees, whether in insurance or real estate, that have continuing education requirements to have additional courses available. If the requirements are the same throughout the state for a course and a course is being offered live, we think this will provide opportunities for somebody from Roseau to take a class in Little Falls, if that's a course they're interested in, and it's being offered in a way that can be live simulcast. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for your support, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions for the members? Is Senator Rothman or Commissioner Rothman still here?
He had to go to the House to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwoody, Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department. Commissioner Rothman had to step out. I would echo Mr. Eager's comments. We have been talking to the Realtors Association and insurance agents about this bill. Appreciate their willingness to accommodate our suggestions on the language and are supportive of the bill.
Mr. Brickwoody, I do have a question related to this subject. If we found a way to not have to keep your computers open once you pass the or meet the requirements of the course. Right now, if you have a course and it's an 8-hour course, if you finish in 3 hours, you have to keep your computer for 8 hours. Is that something we can work on related to this across the industries? Or,
Mr. Chairman, we're certainly always interested in having a conversation with you, Mr. Chairman. I know we've talked about this issue in the past. I believe it may need to involve some broader stakeholders at the national level, as Minnesota subscribes to a nationwide policy on those types of things. But certainly happy to have a conversation with you about this subject.
Would love to. I'll leave it there for now. Any other questions, members? Senator Jensen, would you like to move your bill to the floor?
Yes, I move that Senate file 2178 be approved and moved to the floor.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Good job. Thank you. Do we pass both in session, please?
Dahl. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, I know that my testifiers, and I believe also as I look at the list here for the propane dealers, are all testifying on this bill as we speak in the House. I know that Commissioner Rothman, who also is testifying on my behalf, I think he also went to the House to testify. So that bill was going on. They started over there. We were hoping to maybe get all those folks over here. I will do what you would like, Mr. Chair, in terms of maybe walking through the bill, but I know there may be a testifier or two in the audience, but that's
I think that's a good idea. You could start explaining it, and I think we're going to wait till maybe another day to get the full thrust of the witnesses, okay? Right, Pratt?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to check on you, see if you're awake. Oh, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a little lonely on this end right now.
You're used to it, aren't you?
In a bill that
took about an hour and a half in energy, so it has had some good discussion. I will also say that Senate File 2164 has been around for many years. I think testifiers from the other side will say that this bill has been around from 10 to 12 years. Who knows? But I say that only because this is not a new issue. And it's been exacerbated by the fact that we have had some of the highest prices for propane here, this one of the coldest winters on record as well. So I do believe that the issues that my bill attempts to address have been around for a while. And again, as I mentioned, have been really exacerbated by our very, very cold winter, and I hope that there's some end in sight. I will go over briefly what the bill hopes to do. Let me just make a few other comments. The provisions in this bill are based on consumer protections that apply to all other utilities in the current Minnesota statute, including rural electric co-ops and municipal utilities. Now, some of the provisions you're going to see in this bill are also in other states' regulations, such as Vermont, New Mexico, Maine, Connecticut as well. This bill does not attempt to regulate propane prices. It does require that each propane distributor report those prices to the department, and it also limits some of the fees that they can charge. The bill does not attempt to cap the prices or the profit margins of propane companies. What it does is prohibit vendors from charging unreasonable, non-fuel-related fees, including fees if a customer does not use enough propane, a level that the company might set. I can give you some examples of that as well. Last year, propane companies received nearly $10 million in federal low-income home energy assistance program funds, the LIHEAP funds. And as of February 28th of this year, the industry also received over $11 million in LIHEAP funds, which are scheduled to operate well into May. Significantly more LIHEAP funds will flow into the industry. This bill only applies to those companies that receive over $200,000 in LIHEAP funds. There's a listing in your packet there of those largest companies in terms of the amount of money that they receive in LIHEAP funds. As we've heard, propane supply constraints are likely to continue. In that case, higher prices are also anticipated. Low and fixed income households must be given the opportunity to enter budget agreements and to make payment arrangements in order to afford higher propane prices. Customers whose monthly income is less than the cost of the propane delivery should not be refused delivery if they agree to pay for the fuel over time. So this bill also puts into place the requirement that some payment agreements must be allowed. If the propane industry was truly a competitive one, there may be less of a need for consumer protections. But the industry has consolidated significantly recently, and customers cannot shop for alternative suppliers because the majority lease their tanks, and only the company that rents you the tank can fill the tank with the propane. I suppose they could go to another dealer, but then they're charged fees for emptying the propane, plus the cost of a new tank, et cetera. So it doesn't go without cost just to enter the market into looking for other propane dealers, if indeed there are any other dealers in their particular area. Our public policy should ensure that people can heat their homes regardless of the type of fuel they use to do so. This is not a short-term problem, so short-term solutions won't be adequate. Over the long term, the protection in this bill will help propane customers to maintain service even when prices are higher than normal. We shouldn't wait for another winter or another crisis. We should act to protect the health and safety of the 213,340 households that heat with propane, and in particular the 53,335 low and fixed income customers that heat with propane. So I'll go over the bill in a second, and before the propane industry gets here, they're going to say that no one has probably been had to leave their house because of not being able to get propane, but you are going to hear some examples of where electric stoves had to be used or natural gas stoves or corn burners had to be used because they indeed were not able to get propane. This bill, I want to mention, and again, we raised that threshold to $200,000 because, we're not trying to target the mom-and-pop shops. We do know that they worked hard this past winter. I admire the work and the dedication that these dealers and these truck drivers that they provide for their customers. This is just about putting into place some consumer protections to make sure that, indeed, people are able to get propane when they need it. I'll do the best I can to go over just the real basics of 2164, then I'll see if there's any testifiers that show up, or there may be a few in the audience.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, are we working out the A5 yeah. delete everything amendment? Do we
my question.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the A5, isn't that your amendment, Senator Brown?
That's
no, that is not.
It's a delete everything.
But I'll be glad to offer mine if you'd like.
I don't.
The A5 is a delete everything.
Let the council straighten us out for sure.
Mr. Chairman, members, sometime during the hearing, I believe the page handed out the engrossment we should be working off of, which is SF-2164, the first engrossment. You should see that in the top right corner, which I believe incorporates amendments made in the Environment and Energy Committee. Okay. Senator Brown had also prepared for this meeting delete all amendments, the A5, which he asked be put in the packets as well. So if you see that in the packets, that Senator Brown asked that to be done.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Council. That's the way I read it as well. All right, so Section 1 just establishes definitions for the purposes of this bill. Again, I'm going to be very general in this regard. Section 2 requires a propane distributor to prepare a document listing the current price of propane and other charges or discounts pertaining to residential service, and that document must be distributed as specified. Section 3 requires propane distributors to offer reasonable budget plans over a 12-month period. Section 4 requires a propane distributor to offer a reasonable payment agreement to a low-income customer whose account is delinquent. The agreement must consider specified factors and have a term of no less than 6 months. Section 5 prohibits a propane distributor from discontinuing propane service during the heating season. So basically putting in the cold weather rule for propane, the same cold weather rule that is applied to other utilities. Section 6 prohibits a propane distributor from discriminating between customers as to payment and service options, whether there's no special circumstances, especially for new or low-income folks. Section 7 regulates terms of sale, including minimum deliveries, delivery charges, minimal usage charges. A propane distributor cannot refuse sales to customers under specified conditions and may not require a security deposit during the heating season. That's one of the examples of that I could give before I move on. For example, one of the co-ops, Cenex Northern Star Co-op, requires customers with a 500-gallon tank that uses less than 400 gallons per year to pay an additional $75 a year. Any customer with a 1,000-gallon tank that uses 800 to 1,000 gallons will be charged $150 a year. And if a customer uses less than 800 gallons, they're charged $200 per year. So this would put some regulations in that regard. Section 8 requires a propane dealer to register with an annual report to the Commissioner of Commerce. Section 9 adds liquefied gas refinery to this definition of a refinery or a terminal. Section 10 requires reporting by a terminal to the Commissioner of Commerce when liquefied petroleum gas is unavailable. And then Section 11 allows a commissioner to enforce this discrimination section under Section 45.027, of course, the effective clause in Section 12. So I did carry this bill last year, Mr. Chair, and we never did get a hearing. And again, maybe the milder winter precluded us maybe from needing this, although, again, as some of those questions and comments and complaints still existed. This winter, I know the Department of Commerce, if they're able to testify, will tell you there were over 4,000 calls to their hotline, and many of those were complaints that were to be addressed here. And on cue, the commissioner will talk about some of those complaints and some of the needs for this particular bill. And hope you're not sweating too much running through the tunnel to the house.
Did you have to go to the other building right now?
Yeah.
and back.
You didn't have a mobile unit, did you? No.
Try to stay young and work out.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, I have just for Mr. Rothman's benefit, I just went over the specific pieces of the bill and gave a brief overview. Maybe you'd like to talk about what you think are some of the needs or the concerns and the reasons for this. Thank you.
Mr. Rothman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, the propane crisis has been a very significant problem for Minnesota this year. I haven't testified in this committee, but in several in the Senate and the House already about propane crisis, the supply problems we've had, the spike in pricing, as well as our administration's and the governor's actions with respect to the propane crisis. And then with respect to this bill, we support it, and we have included several provisions we think are helpful to strengthen it. A few of the things I did want to mention is that when the hotline was put up, we received and have received nearly 4,000 phone calls to us. The Department of Commerce staff fielded all those calls. 50% of those calls involved people who were seeking low-income heating assistance, and the rest, the greater majority of them were people complaining about the prices, about consumer practices against them, problems with fees, problems with delays in delivery, problems with making sure that their homes were being heated. And so with that, the department worked very closely with the community action agencies. I know they're here. I want to acknowledge and again thank all of their hard work, all the work of their staff to be able to facilitate making sure people had propane in their home during sub-zero weather. We also worked in connection with the Propane Association, and I want to acknowledge again their work. Mr. Chair, members, at times going into some of our sub-zero weekends, there were people calling saying they were totally out, absolutely no propane left in their tanks. We also came to a point where even 0 to 10% was a serious life-threatening and serious problem for people if they were going to run out. So what we did is we expedited crisis benefits. We expedited making sure people got propane to their home, either through the community action agencies. We had a direct hotline set up between us, the department, and the Propane Association, who went out and filled tanks, made sure that people had at least a minimum fill. For this bill, we feel that it offers some important consumer protections. It clarifies that propane dealers cannot discriminate on the basis of customers' ability to pay. It clarifies terms of sale issues that we think are important, and an important reporting requirement to the department so that we know when the next propane crisis might hit us. In particular, the department suggested amending and strengthening and have clearer language on this discrimination provision. We also wanted to make sure that that the bill particularly address the consumer protection needs. We know that there are some issues and things that we're having conversations about with the senator and any in the stakeholders with respect to the bill, and the department is willing and able, wants to work with everybody to get a good resolution for our consumers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. We got a little more time, Senator Sarka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Rothman, we first day we passed, I believe it was $20 million to LIHEAP we recognized an urgency there. And this is not my area of expertise, but I wonder, did you have any discussion or thought about trying to make the changes within LIHEAP? Because it really has to do with people that are particularly needy, and I'm just wondering if it would have been better going that direction.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gizelka. It's a very good question. The difficulty that people faced this heating season wasn't limited to the low-income heating assistance, and that was part of the problem. Minnesota has traditionally a 50% of the state median income as the ability of people to get low-income heating assistance. And we received dozens and hundreds of calls from people who did not qualify for low-income heating assistance, maybe $50 or $100 or, you know. And these are hardworking Minnesotans in greater Minnesota who can't even qualify for low-income heating assistance. So one thing we did is we increased the eligibility requirement to 60% of the state median income, and we increased the crisis benefits. And then we, by doing that, yes, we needed additional funding, the $20 million to make it through the winter. But it didn't address all of the issues for the rest of the non-low-income heating assistance people who still had issues with getting deliveries, with the price, with all that. And then if you'll recall, the governor directed me to very carefully watch the pricing. I did issue a letter to the propane industry saying that when it hit $6.67 in some areas, triple what the traditional price has been, around $1.60 or $1.70, it did not limit itself to low-income heating people, and it hammered the heck out of not only residences but small businesses who just couldn't afford those kinds of prices. So, yeah. So some of this is relates to that.
Mr. Chair, to the commissioner again, I got an email from somebody that provides propane up in my area, and he said what will happen is no one will want these customers because they think they're a liability, and at the end of the day, we still have the right to refuse service and remove our tank, you know. So those that are particularly needy are, it's not going to solve their issue, at least according to this person's perspective. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to increase costs for everyone. And so I'm trying to figure out if there's a way that we can get all the players involved in a solution rather than forcing a solution on a group of people.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gizelka, I know that the author and then those who are the stakeholders interested in the bill have some thoughts on that. I would point out that there is a provision in the bill that basically exempts. It's in the propane. What is the definition of propane distributor? The smaller propane companies are intended to be unaffected in a way. So you have to receive more than $200,000 in payments before this is even triggered. So some of the really smaller companies would not be affected by this, and so. And I know there was a lower trigger or lower threshold event, but this is meant to increase it so that to try and address that very question you had.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, of course, don't have a lot of propane users in my district, but I have people that have family in rural areas. And one of the things I keep hearing is that they have prepaid for propane in the summer and bought it at the lower price, and now they're getting very high delivery charges. And it looks as if your bill will address that. Have you had a number of complaints about that, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, yes, we did. And as I was saying, about 50% or more of the complaints on the hotline were about prices and as well as those delays. And many of them were those folks who had the prepaid contracts. And, you know, some of it was coming in at us at a very quick pace. So, for example, we had heard that in some instances companies were delaying on the prepaid contracts, but expediting and going out and paying or filling on when it was cash only and filling those tanks all the way up. So we tried to address those issues, brought them to the attention of the propane companies when we got those complaints, tracked them all. But, yes, we did have those issues.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Marshall, did you wish to testify? Welcome. Oh, excuse me. Before that, Senator Brown, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you talked about the high price of propane, but wasn't that the result of the availability of being able to get propane to market? Senator Dahl's bill tends to impose regulations on the propane delivery businesses, and I'm not sure that's the core of the problem. I think it was an Energy Committee you testified you had met with, I think, some other commissioners of commerce in the Midwest and talked about a long-term solution for storage and so forth. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, if you'll indulge me for a few minutes, it's a, kind of a bit of an explanation, but the root cause of what created the propane crisis for Minnesota, when we look at it and take the information from the propane industry, came down to about three or four very, very critical pieces. The first was, or is, that the amount of propane exported from the United States to other countries increased significantly, threefold, from 5% to a 20% amount of the propane from the United States. And so all of that propane was being exported to other countries, or in the process of being exported. Second, we experienced the late harvest and the wet season, and as you know, the agriculture drying put an extreme demand, unexpected, more than the propane industry understood was going to happen for this year, and put a very high demand on the supply. Third, in December, the Kinder Morgan's Cochin pipeline, which is scheduled to, which is a totally different issue, but it's a significant issue, which is scheduled to reverse in April, was shut down for maintenance for a period of 3 weeks. It was originally going to be done at harvest time, but they moved that into December and before winter hit in the hardest portions of, you know, the coldest in January. So those impacted us as well. And then the fourth thing that happened is we had the massive polar vortex that hit not just Minnesota, but the Midwest and the Northeast region. So all of the northern states put a tremendous demand on the whole supply. And we're now actually in a situation where we're probably at roughly, I'm told, 60% of the normal supply in the whole country for what we have of propane and inventory. So we're still, even though it's warm out today, we're still, if we have any cold weather for March, we're going to be still kind of touch and go. In response, the administration did a few things. Governor Dayton, as you'd indicated, we met with the propane industry, focused on supply issues by doing the following. First, the governor issued an hour of service exemption for trucks so the trucks could go out and get more propane. He reached out to the White House. There was a delegation letter, a congressional delegation letter, and the governor that was sent to the administration. And in response, the governor also called a couple of the CEOs of the pipeline industry for bringing propane here, and asked that they prioritize propane shipments to Minnesota and the Midwest, actually to Conway, Kansas, so that we could get some up to the Midwest. And in response, the propane pipeline industry and the suppliers reversed direction, got some supply up into the Midwest. And then another significant factor was the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issued an extraordinary order, which has never been done before, to require propane to be shipped up the pipelines to the Midwest. And those actions brought supply into the Midwest. So that we were able to bring the supply in, and the price in response has come down. We're still almost close to still twice the normal price of what propane is. But you're right. The propane we were able to get propane delivered up here, and I would just say this, that going forward we still are in a touch and go situation. But we also need to be on our radar screens the fact that. The Cochin pipeline delivers 40% of our propane to Minnesota. It's going to reverse, and that propane won't be coming to Minnesota anymore as of April. And in response, the propane industry, railroad industry, the trucking industry, the farming industry, residential, everybody that's relying on propane are in a conversation to try to figure out a way to find a replacement source or to bring that supply to Minnesota in a different fashion. So we still have going to have some supply issues, but on the other side, we feel that these are important protections that need to be put in place to monitor, you know, sort of the other issues that come up when we have shortages and price spikes.
Okay. I think Texas, did they relax their trucking issues or requirements to allow more trucks to haul propane to Minnesota?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when our truckers were refused entry into Texas at their terminals to pick up, because in Texas there's a rule that says only Texas trucks can load at their terminals. Not only Minnesota, but others did as well. And the administration, we reached out to the Governor Perry's office. The Lieutenant Governor there signed an order allowing trucks from Minnesota and other states to pick up down there. And then Governor Dayton actually was on a conference call with other governors and Governor Perry to make sure that the extension happened so that we could get, you know, trucks could continue to go down there and pick up propane.
Yeah, it's got to be helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, we have another Senator Dahl. Do you wish to introduce your...
Mr. Chair, yes. Pam Marshall from Energy Sense would like to say a few words. Thanks.
Ms. Marshall, how are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, fine members. I apologize for a redundancy. This bill is up in House Energy at exactly the same moment. I did want to refer you to some of the handouts in your packet. One is a price survey that looks like this. One is a propane fact sheet, and one is titled Feral Gas Master Agreement. I'm going to refer to those a bit throughout. And again, I apologize if this is redundant, but at the level that we're talking about, the $200,000 of LIHEAP money, 24 propane companies would be subject to the provisions in this bill. I would urge members to keep in mind that over 213,000 Minnesota households heat with propane. About 54,000 of those are low-income households. The average annual income for energy assistance households that heat with propane is about $16,600 a year. In any given month at that level of income, if you had to purchase 400 gallons worth of propane, depending on your vendor and what price you were being charged, but the range as of March 4th, if you were charged the low part of that range, you'd be spending 65% of that monthly income for propane, and at the high price end of that range, you'd be spending 100% of your monthly income. And that's precisely why this bill simply asks companies to make payment arrangements and to provide budget plans for customers that they do not normally invite to participate in those plans. Feral Gas, for example, if you look at your in your packet at that master agreement, in the middle of that page, their contract states, your payment option plan is pay in advance. If you're a pay in advance customer, they may allow you to pay cash on delivery. But then again, as it says in the next paragraph on that, if you are a pay in advance customer, we may allow you to pay cash, but at our discretion, we may inform you that you no longer qualify. I'm not exactly sure what's required to qualify to pay cash, but these are some of the provisions that are lifted exactly from their agreements that make it very difficult for low and fixed income people to pay over time. We are working with the industry. This is a work in progress. We want to come up with some reasonable payment terms. We want the cold weather rule or the payment arrangement provisions of the bill to mirror the cold weather rule section in the bill, insofar as if you do miss two consecutive payments, we think it's reasonable that you would be refused a delivery under those terms. We think it's a lot less likely that you would be in that position if you were allowed to pay over time in the first place. And as long as you make those payments, that you would continue to get service, to get fuel delivered. Those provisions are modeled on provisions we already have for rural electric co-ops, municipal utilities, and investor-owned utilities to one extent or another under both the utility consumer protection statutes and under our current cold weather rule. So this is not just, this bill is not just a reaction to price. It's a bill that would, you know, limit security deposits. It would limit fees for minimal deliveries. It would most importantly limit fees if you did not use enough propane, which is a level also set by the propane companies. And tries to limit all of those non-fuel related costs that only exacerbate low-income customers' ability to pay for service. The anti-discrimination provisions are in this bill are important. I've had a mobile home park owner call me to tell me that even with cash in hand, new residents to his park are refused service, even if their parents are with them and offer to pay the first for the first fill and the payment for leasing their tank. And I know that you're going to hear a lot about this is different. This business is different. This is, industry is competitive. Well, actually, the majority of customers in this industry lease their tanks for about $10 to $50 a year, depending on the company. The only company that can fill that tank is the company that leases it to you. You can. It is a consumer choice to go out and try to purchase a tank, but the average cost of the typical size tank is $1,500. In an energy assistance household, at their income level, you'd be paying 10% of your income just to buy your tank. That doesn't count the switch-out fees, and it also doesn't account for the price per gallon being pretty similar, such that you'd be looking at a fairly long payback period. The reporting provisions are important in this bill as well, and we do have some companies that voluntarily provide their weekly retail prices to the Energy Information Administration and then through them back to the Department of Commerce. But what we don't have is all of the companies reporting those prices, so that if you look at that spreadsheet in your packet, you will see that in the week of January 27th, the lowest state price for propane was $3.11 and the highest state price was $5.90. Nothing about the shortage explains that variation, that wide variation in propane prices. We think it would be important for the state to be able to know what's going on behind some of those numbers and also what the companies are purchasing it for. We think reasonable payment agreements, you know, limiting the stacking of various fees that are charged to folks, lowering those minimal delivery amounts so that people can actually afford to pay under the terms of the propane companies' contracts are all necessary consumer protections that, frankly, in this industry, regardless of the price, are overdue. Mr. Chair, since we've been working on this for a really long time, and I think one of the differences in recent years is we've seen a lot of industry consolidation. We see companies, the ones that would be subject to this bill, many of them operate in multi-state jurisdictions, have as many as 2 million customers. In their own words, are achieving margin and cash flow growth despite increases in the underlying cost of propane. And they hold all the power in the transaction between themselves and the customers, and we think we need to find a reasonable way to rectify that imbalance. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have.
Senator Kosoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, do you know roughly how many people that use propane would have available to them natural gas?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do not. I do not know that. I do know that there are some Public Utilities Commission precedents that make it more difficult to put the natural gas infrastructure in place. And frankly, it may be time to remove some of those barriers.
Thank you, Mr.
Rappin, did you ever try to answer that or give an opinion on
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, if I could just shed a little light on that. Predominantly, you know, we, as indicated, about 213,000 residences are on propane. Typically, these are in the greater rural Minnesota where those gas lines don't go to. And one of the good questions that have come up is, well, how do we get the gas lines extended to those areas? And so the department is looking into that issue with the Public Utilities Commission. But at the same time, generally, these are harder to reach areas for natural gas supplies.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, part of the reason I asked it is I switched from propane to natural gas. I'm in outstate, but, you know, the Brainerd Lakes area is, that maybe is an indication that it's not as rural as some places. But, you know, I made a choice. I had some electric, I had some propane, and I moved to natural gas and electric, and I kind of, you know, try to make the best choice. You know, so I feel like, you know, we have an opportunity to you know, make a choice. Do we want to use electric? Do we want to use propane, natural gas, et cetera? But one of the things I was concerned about is if we start taking away some of their ability to charge costs for whatever they're charging costs for, it would be my assumption then that somewhere those costs are going to be paid. It's just going to drive up the overall rate for everyone to pay. You know, I was hoping that we were going to have a bill that was actually dealing with supply and some of the issues that I think are deeper and bigger than what we're scratching at here. And I think all the testifiers acknowledge that it really isn't about that. It's this is a bill that's been ongoing for a while. But in the end, I don't think it really does anything to deal with costs, and it's not going to address the shortages. And that was where I hoped we would go. But at the end of the day, we're, you know, people that have it are going to pay more if they're not in those categories that we're making exceptions for.
No question. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Ms. Marshall, maybe I misunderstood what you said or didn't hear it correctly, but I thought you mentioned something about the rural electric co-ops having budget programs, which they do. And we're trying to tie that into the LP situation. And I think that's really a reach when we try to do that. The rural electric co-op, I'm a member of one, and I only have one electrical line go by my house. I either take their electricity or I don't have any. I have four LP providers that provide to my house. So to state that this would be similar to what the rural electric co-ops, I think, is a misstatement in the fact that I do have options with LP. I do not have options with the electric co-op. So I don't want people, the general public that are listening to this, to think that this is the same as an electric co-op, and that the budgeting process would be the same as what this is. I think that's a difference, and I think we have to make sure that that's clearly understood. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. I think maybe Commissioner Rothman can answer this. First of all, my understanding is that these things only apply to those companies that after they make $200,000 or more. And I think you said there were 24 or 26 companies that do that. What percentage of the market is that, and what happens to the customers that aren't involved in this legislation that don't have those coverage from those 24 or 26 people? Does that mean that those companies can still charge high delivery prices and not fill the tanks of people that have prepaid first and so forth? Some of those practices that I think are just consumer consumer problems, regardless of the amount of money the company makes or whatever, that is another way of cheating the customer, no matter how much, because they get to use that consumer's money all the time once they prepaid for their gas, but yet then they're penalizing them for it down the road if the gas prices go up. So that's going to still happen, correct, with companies that don't meet the $200,000 cash limit?
Okay, what's the Senator?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, on your first question, I don't have the data to answer the percentage. I'd ask that of the propane industry. The Department of Commerce tracks from time prices. We do probably have a good sense of the companies that are out there. I could figure that out, but we don't have the actual financial data. And as you know, the propane industry is an unregulated, meaning the Department of Commerce doesn't regulate the propane industry.
Sorry.
And so we don't have that data. Second, the second part of your question is a fair question. And it's my understanding, maybe, you know, Ms. Marshall can also help with that. But I would share your concern that these are meant to have those protections. Let me just also say this, too. I think, you know, when you're the smaller companies, too, in this particular situation, when the major supplies were closed down or weren't coming into Minnesota, and then in this marketing and the distribution channel, there's a lot of companies that were upside down that were also locked into low price contracts, and they had this massive price increase making it difficult on them. So I would ask the same question and say, the you know, from my perspective, consumer protections are important and should be addressed across the board if we can. If it's one of those situations where we would put consumers in a more serious problem by not having supplies, by not having the smaller companies around, there's a bit of a question there to be balanced. So.
And, Mr. Chair, my suggestion isn't that we put all companies in under the same regulations, but that some of the true consumer protection things in here that are just plain fairness issues, like those two I mentioned. There could be exceptions. There could be just a certain amount of those companies that have to fall, that all companies have to fall under. There are some exceptions that all companies have to fall under. It's just a suggestion.
Okay, making pretty good progress here. Anybody else? We've got about 5 more minutes if somebody else wants to. We're not going to complete this project today, but we're going to lay this over.
And Mr. Chair, to that, and I have seen Senator Brown's amendments, and as I look at it, there are some things that are very similar, pulled right, I think, some similar language right out of our bill. So, you know, we got that amendment from the industry 20 minutes before Thursday's meeting. Ms. Marshall was in Wisconsin this weekend. I don't know why. I was on a plane out west, somewhere warmer. So we haven't had a chance to maybe sit down. And I know that the commissioner has also received a copy of these proposals. And I also know that I think the president of the propane dealers and one of the lobbyists is in the other, probably still in the other room, so in the house. But anyway, it is.
So
they're here now. Oh, they've arrived. Great. So it isn't like we are dismissing their reach out on that. And you know, I'd be glad to continue working on this. Hopefully, we can find some agreement on some of the concerns
that
we have.
Exactly, Senator. What we try to do in this committee. It doesn't always work, but if we can reach a consensus, it'd be wonderful. But we're going to hear from a few more people because of this. It's not going to get done today, but I'd like to hear from as many people as we can. But we've got a few more minutes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
My name is Steve Nagel, and I'm with West Central Minnesota Community Action. We deliver the low-income energy program across 7 counties from Glenwood to Moorhead, and we serve about 6,000 families a year. That's up considerably this season, and we deal with 120 different vendors across those 7 counties. And with me today are some folks who are going to talk about some of the difficulty getting deliveries, the pricing, and related matters. Diane Bender is an energy assistance intake person, and Maggie Fabry is a customer who serves on our Head Start Policy Council and is a customer of the low-income energy program.
Okay, sure. We'd like to hear from you, ma'am.
Mr. Chair and committee. It's nice to be here today and listen to all of you folks with some of the other information that was given. We do have a household.
Just give them your name.
Oh.
Just say your name again.
My name is Diane Bender, and I'm from West Central Minnesota Community Action. I'm the Energy Assistance and Weatherization Coordinator there. And we had a household that applied for energy assistance this last fall. They established an account with a large fuel vendor. Once energy assistance then was granted, the fuel vendor delivered the tank, and, of course, the line and regulator to the household. In the order, my understanding was there was supposed to be a minimum delivery of fuel because the primary heat benefit would cover that. There was no delivery. The large vendor only delivered the tank, line, and regulator. The household called our office, worried, concerned, we're going to run out of fuel, it's getting cold. This was in late December. And the fuel vendor then, in contacting them, had said due to the weather and cold conditions, they were unable to service the area. In my conversation with the household, I had asked them, can we then try to find another vendor who will deliver fuel to you? And we both worked together to try to find a vendor, and we were unsuccessful. We had a smaller co-op actually go out to the home, and it was his, upon visiting the household there and seeing the setup, it was a rural place where they live, rural residents, and they then had stated no, they could not deliver there because obviously the tank was not theirs. So the household at this point has been heating with space heaters. Their electric bill right now is $2,500. These folks are in their 60s and very sad situation. And in talking with this large vendor again and trying to get someone to deliver, we had the refusal again of no. Due to the weather and road conditions at this time, we will not be able to deliver.
Thank you very much. Another witness member.
Hi, my name is Maggie Fagry, and I'm on the Policy Council, and I, too, am a customer of one of the large companies who are on your list. And when I call to make a payment to get fuel, I have to call three other local propane dealers to get an average price, of which then I call my company back and say, I'd like to order fuel. We are always prepaid, and they give me an astronomical price, and I say, well, local areas are charging this much. Is there anything we can do? They then lower it a little bit, and I say, we're still have a large range, and then they lower it again. I receive my bill, and the bill is not the price they quoted me, but it's the original price that was stated. So then I call again, and for each time I receive fuel, I get about three bills, all varying in prices that we're supposed to pay based on what we're told. We also ran into a situation at Christmas where we were trying to get fuel, and we called 10 days in advance. Christmas Eve came, and they finally delivered us fuel. We were at 5%.
And when households get, as we all know, very low on fuel, the concern also is small children in the home, pipes freezing. One thing leads to another. What can happen is such a ripple effect. And one thing that I have observed as well is with calling the larger vendors and them stating a price, because we do ask for minimum delivery for crisis dollars, and what is your price today, they do have to then, after delivery, give us a copy of that ticket and state where that tank was at upon delivery time and the price that we agreed on, and we do negotiate at that time as well.
Sorry.
Because there are additional fees that are tacked on typically for same-day price, same-day delivery, etc. But we do find that there is a variance in price when we do get that ticket from the time that we are told, or, you know, we are speaking with somebody in the larger fuel vendor companies, and we're told one price, and it comes up when we get the ticket, it's much larger price. So that is a huge concern.
Oh, they can do that, but I don't know. We've got time, I believe, for one more witness, and then we're going to lay this over. And you want to get, sir, you're kind of get Nancy over there. You want to? Is that a technical term?
Nancy.
Yeah, we've only got a couple minutes. Like, our members have other meetings at
2 o'clock. So. Mr. Chair and Senators Nancy Selesky representing the Minnesota Gas Propane Gas Association.
Thank you.
As everyone's indicated, this hearing is going on over in the House, so we're kind of scrambling between hearings. I just wanted to add that industry has been meeting with Commerce and the advocates. We met with Pam Marshall this morning as well as the department, and we're working on language. We're on about draft 6 now. I think our proposal contains probably about 70% of what Senator Dahl's bill looks like. We have issues still, and we'd like to continue to work with them. They've indicated that they'll work with us as well. I do have Will Norman, who is the president of the Propane Gas Association, with us today, and I think he wanted to make a couple of comments.
Sure.
And to address what's been talked about thus far.
Norman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and the public as well. It's hard for me to sit and hear those stories. It's very difficult. Up here in Minnesota, for a period of a number of months, we need to stay warm. And I'm very proud of what my company, Como Oil and Propane in Duluth, and all the propane industry does. So to hear these stories are alarming, and they're sad. No one likes to hear these stories. I know that the majority of the companies distributing propane, and there's 170 of them in Minnesota, do their best on a day-in and day-out basis to provide safe, reliable service and to keep people warm. That's our job. We're a delivery company. I heard a lot of things today. The commissioner did a wonderful job discussing what led up to the crisis. He was 100% accurate. But this bill doesn't respond to the issues that caused that crisis. It issues more regulations to only a select few companies that they will now have to deal with. I was told this morning when the price hit $4.99, that was the high in Duluth, 60% of our customers were paying $1.79 because they prepaid. And we also offer prepay payments for people that can't afford to pay for all their gas up front, up to 6 months. So 60% of our customers were paying $1.79. We did not miss one delivery. It was very difficult. Our drivers have been on 6 12-hour days for about 13 weeks right now. They're doing everything in their power to deliver propane and to keep people warm. Are we perfect? Obviously not. Obviously not. There's some serious things that have occurred. I don't think that people should think that's an accurate representation of the propane industry in its entirety. There's a number of things that have occurred. By the way, we're on the list. I can't tell you what a great job LIHEAP does. We work so closely with them. They do a wonderful job. They need more money. They need to get the money in the summertime so that people can buy their propane when it's typically 30 to 40 cents cheaper. So LIHEAP is doing a fantastic job. I don't know where this bill provides any additional consumer protection. There's 170 companies, there's 9 in my area, and last year we set 968 tanks. That means we got 968 new customers. We picked up 690 tanks, which means we lost 690 customers. People change propane companies all the time. And she had a good point this morning. There might be a household or some house out in some area that is only served by one, but boy, I'd like to know where that is. There are multiple propane companies, and if someone isn't doing it right, then the consumer should change to somebody who cares. And I know there's a lot of us out there that care tremendously on how we take care of our customers. And then I had a funny thought. My natural gas went up, doubled. I hope there's hearings on that as well, because natural gas supposedly is the cheaper fuel. My natural gas went up double. But all I got on my bill was a PUC adjustment. You pay the difference. You don't have any choice. In the propane industry, you do have a choice. You find a good company that takes care of you, and you do what you have to do. So,
okay. Very good. Anybody else? Come on up, sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
My name's Greg Perkle. I own Perkle Gas in Owatonna, Minnesota. To hear these stories is heartbreaking. What we've gone through this last winter, it's been 7 weeks of hell. Trying to get propane, trying to get propane to our customers. My wife takes, you talk about taking 100 or so calls at the whatever group it was. My wife was taking 130 calls a day trying to work out a payment plan with people and trying to work with these people. We've known these customers our whole life. My dad started the company in 1959. I started in 78 when I was 18 years old. I have no intention of letting anybody go without heat. We have got a contract with a supplier right now to add 4 45,000-gallon tanks at our facility in Owatonna to try and help with supply situations. None of our customers waited one minute for supply during corn drying or through this heating season. We were charging less for the propane than we were paying because we were averaging it in with the supply we had on hand. We've put supply storage in place at our bulk plants. But with this bill, and if you talk, somebody had the idea to pass this on to the smaller, I don't care if it's a big one or a small one, this man's trying his best too. I seriously consider canceling the order for the tanks and just pulling the plug. We have got to get paid for what we deliver. We cannot physically handle the cash flow of you know, it sounds great. Nobody wants anybody to freeze to death, but it's a team. It's a team between our customer and us. They have to try. We need them, and they need us. They have to try, and they do, and so do we. We have extended more credit than we ever have in the past, and they have paid a little bit more than they ever have in the past, to the best of their ability. Every case is different. We work with them hand in hand. I don't know what else to say. Just say that this last 7 weeks has not been easy on anybody. Now to come up with a whole bunch of new regulations on the industry, I'm afraid you're going to hurt the people you're trying to help. Because you take a bunch of the choices away from these customers. In my area, I have 18 different propane companies I compete with. I hear these stories of that they wouldn't deliver to your house. Why? I don't know why you wouldn't call another supplier to bring a tank. And as far as a charge to bring a tank, we don't charge to bring a tank. We pump it out, we do the switchover, we do a safety check, make sure the regulators are all in place, what they should be, all for no charge. We shake their hand and say, I hope we have a good business relationship. But we have to get paid. We can't do it for nothing.
I would like to add one comment that was made earlier about the tank leases and customers being held captive. The reason that the propane companies want to own the tanks is 100% for safety and liability reasons.
That's why we want to own the tank.
Customers that they own the tank, they don't
know how to take care of that tank.
They don't know
how to replace
the valve. Liability. Our company pays
$650,000
a year for insurance. Why? Because propane
is a gas. And it can be dangerous, which means maintenance is paramount. And safety is our
number one issue.
That's why we want to own the tanks. That is the number one reason.
I'm
concerned that container law is going to be
revisited later,
and so I wanted to put that up.
We do deliver to COTs. We've never, ever had anybody leave their
home in 10 years. I know somebody said you're going to hear that, but
all of my friends, all of my propane friends in the state, never have had anybody have to leave their
home in the winter
for a lack of heat. Never.
I do have one comment on that container law, too. Just one little quick story. I had a customer call one time in May, and we had just filled him in March, and he doesn't use that much gas. He says, Greg, can you come out and fill us up? We're down to 10%. I says, geez, Bob, that seems like a lot of gas. He goes, well, it was a cold spring. I said, it wasn't that cold. I said, before we put more gas in the tank, we're going to check it. And we went out there and we checked the lines, and here he had a leak going into the shop. It was leaking gas. It leaked probably 200 gallons of gas. But if anybody can come into these yards and fill the tanks, this guy this time, this guy the next time, all into the tank I may own, who's going to watch it for the safety? And what insurance company will want to insure a situation like that? It'll drive us out of business. That's why we own the tanks.
Before we deliver to any customer, we do a full leak check and audit check on their whole system. The tank, the regulators, and the piping. And every company has to do that by code.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any did you wish to testify, or you're just sitting there?
Mr. Chairman, I was Court Holton for the Propane Delivery Businesses of Minnesota. I was over at the house doing the same thing. The same thing is going on over there. So, and I'm not going to spend more than a couple minutes, but if I say stuff you already heard, I'm sure you won't feel bad about cutting me off. A couple of things to correct. This business of how many companies this affects. The way the bill is written presently, and maybe that's not the intent, it includes all of the co-ops as well. So it's about close to 70% of our customers. I keep hearing that we're only trying to go after 20 companies, but that's not how the bill is presently drafted. That may be a technical thing. What is the propane industry? I think that's an important thing to understand. It's not big oil. The propane industry, there is big propane. That's the people that own that natural resource and the pipelines, and they move it to our state. Our business in Minnesota is a delivery business. It works like this. We go to the money people, and we get money. We get bank loans. We get letters of credit. We get credit-based financing. Then we go to the propane people, and we buy the propane. That's a financed purchase. We fill up our trucks, and we go to our consumers, our customers, and we sell the propane to them. We need those receipts from those sales so that we can maintain our financing so that we can go back to the propane people and buy the next round of propane. If we're going to have to finance our customers being financed ourselves, that's two levels of financing stacked on top of each other, that business model will not work. That will fail. Two other things. One is that we're just like the utilities. That is just so not true. We don't have a guaranteed customer base. We don't have a price that does not have to be competitive under the circumstances. We don't have an absolute guarantee that on the 16th of April, if somebody owes money, that we'll get paid. And the utilities customers can't call up and say, come and get your electricity line, I'm going with somebody else. Or come and get your natural gas line. You know, that's the situation they're in. We're not in that situation. And lastly, the problem that the bill is aimed at is a legitimate problem. It wasn't a product of 2014. You know, 2014 was a phenomenon in itself, which could repeat. We all know that. The problem of people of limited means obtaining fuels is a legitimate problem. And if we're going to address that, it's our responsibility, us taxpayers, to address that. And in an amendment that we've proposed, I don't know if it's been discussed today, we offer a new idea in that arena, and that would be a short-term loan program that would operate in about the same time frame as a cold weather rule does, state funded, that would get people that are in need in emergency situations credit fast, and that they would pay it back fast, like those who benefit presently from the cold weather rule. What I hope you guys will start looking at is transportation storage capacity, and I think we need to understand the Bakken phenomena and the effect that it's having on Minnesotans. We really need to understand that better. Thank you.
I think there could be some kind of model you're talking about, Kurt?
Court.
It's a model like, I didn't get it all, and some pool of money that you could go. Do we do that in the natural gas, and do we do that in electricity, or the state backs up some money there?
Yeah, that would be another
option
idea. I mean, we can't effectively be turned into a utility just because the infrastructure wouldn't make any sense. But you could the state. There are models that we could use where there was state ultimate responsibility. But bear in mind, the financing is an ongoing thing. Yeah. And the people that rate us credit-wise, as we have to pick up perhaps bad debt, even if down the road there's a guarantee for it, it's going to affect our rating, and it's going to affect the cost of which we get financing, and that cost will be passed on to customers who are paying their bills.
Okay, I think the authors said, and others, and the commissioner and Senator Brown and interested folks, that this is still a little work in progress. We're not there yet, and so we're going to lay this over, and all I can say is keep working. So oftentimes things just maybe can't be worked out, but around here we like, if we can work it out, we'll do the best we can. Okay? We meet Wednesday at noon. Try to get here on time. The bill will be laid over. Okay. Thank you.